on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
I just want to write stories because I like writing stories, and I'm not really into it for the money or the fame or the fortune or anything. I like helping people, and all my stories have some sort of theme to them that is designed to help people be better, I guess.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome. It's The Self-Publishing Show with me, James Blatch.
And me, Mark Dawson. Hello.
Hello, Mark Dawson. You're a busy man with your author career at the moment, which is, you know, interfering in my business, which I do with you. So I'd like you to stop writing and focus. I noticed this weekend you did an offer on book one of your series, even to your list. Tell me about this strategy.
Well, I did a KCD, so a Kindle Countdown deal, which I haven't done for a while. I should do them more often because they're pretty effective. You get the 70% royalty, even if you drop the price down to 99 cents. So it can be quite effective. And I wanted to run one on the first in the series, knowing that, you know, the sale of one book is worth more than just the 70 whatever cents I'd be getting on a 99 cent sale. And if I look over there, I have a big whiteboard in the office with a fairly extensive Facebook campaign that I put together last week. So, how many have we got? About 10 different ad sets, UK and US, different targets, lookalikes, engagement lists, interests, all kinds of stuff. Running it fairly aggressive. I want you to spend a little bit heavier. My ad spend has dropped a lot at the moment. It's about 9% of revenue right now, which obviously that's great in that its profit is quite high. But I wanted to invest a little bit in this campaign. So I think I'm spending about $500 a day for the rest of the week to try and drive these sales. And I did a blast to the list yesterday as well. And then immediately got 5 or 6 emails from readers saying, I've gone over to the Amazon.com store page and it's weird. And I couldn't easily replicate it from over here. So I asked in the SPF group and maybe 50 people were seeing the page was on some kind of automatic refresh loop, which meant that you couldn't get to the buy button before it refreshed, which was quite annoying given that I just sent out 100,000 emails. Yes. And just fired off this Facebook campaign, so people wouldn't have been able to buy it. It was very weird. I emailed Amazon, haven't got a reply back yet, but within an hour, as a few SPF community members suggested would happen, it cleared up and it looks fine now. So it's weird. So it's obviously, it's happened before. Others said that this has happened to them. So just kind of a heads up to anybody who's thinking about doing a KCD, it's probably worth letting it run for a couple of hours before you actually do anything to send any traffic to it. And probably also check it yourself if you're in the US. It looks like it's only the US that's affected. And maybe get other people in the US to check it for you, because there's nothing more irritating, as I discovered yesterday, to send all this traffic to a page that can't convert. Yeah. So, yeah, there you go.
Now, on another subject, we've had a few mentions in the group about Facebook campaigns being variously suspended for different reasons. I mean, I've had one this week, but it's just been, it's clearly a glitch where you just get a note saying that your campaign's been picked up in breach of political campaigning guidelines or something, and you ask for a review and it gets reinstated quickly. Other people have said that they're starting to suspect that maybe Facebook doesn't like Amazon links in campaigns, which would be, let's face it, a massive blow to us if that was the case. But I've seen your posts and others in the groups, and you're not convinced that would be a serious threat.
No, I'm very, very far from convinced. It doesn't make any sense at all. So I mean, if the suggestion was, what this kind of the genesis was, someone made the mistake of speaking to a Facebook rep. So, and I've seen you've been speaking to a Facebook rep as well. So
is this a mistake? I've got a couple of tips for my rep.
No, I don't rate them at all. I mean, that's a blanket statement. So I'm sure there are plenty of good Facebook reps. Unfortunately, I've never met any of them. And some of the advice I've seen to community members has been, how should I put this? Tainted perhaps by, you know, you should be running these campaigns. Now, these are the ones that, you know, basically they're not being, these reps are not employed by you. They're not giving unbiased advice. They're employed by Facebook to make money for Facebook. So, and in my experience, their advice is variable. I'll be polite at best. So anyway, the issue was an author's VA or assistant contacted a Facebook rep, and the Facebook rep said to her that you're not allowed to link from a Facebook ad to Amazon. So she posted this in the group. She was quite upset because it obviously has, I think she's had some issues with ads being shut down, possibly the account being suspended. This is obviously bad. So if, you know, she was doing very well, I won't name her, but she was doing very well with Facebook. It was becoming a fundamental part of her her career, really, her platform, and to suddenly have that taken down and then to be told you can't use Facebook ads to advertise Amazon products. So she posted this, and immediately my reaction is that doesn't make any logical sense at all, because Amazon is the biggest online retailer on the planet, unless there's a Chinese one that's caught up with it. But as far as I know, it's you know, it's the biggest on the planet. Why on earth would Facebook want to say to advertisers you can't advertise Facebook products? Sorry, Amazon products. It just doesn't make any sense. So I started digging around. I contacted some people who I know, who know quite a lot, both from the Amazon side and the Facebook side specifically. And we couldn't find any, there's no confirmation at all that there's any issue here. My campaigns that I just mentioned, they're all running, no issues at all. They're all going directly to Amazon. We looked at all kinds of reasons why it might be. And the only conclusion that we could come to was that this was just a rep who doesn't know what he or she is talking about. Because it just, you know, it just does not make sense. We looked affiliate links. We looked at, we were using short or long links or clean links. There was no consistency with people reporting issues with their ads. And what it comes down to, I think, is that it's just Facebook is shutting down tons of ads at the moment, as you say. It's partly because I think there's some glitchiness. I think they're being very sensitive about the US election. And also they're changing their front end. So the interface that we're seeing, or the kind of the public facing side of Facebook, is having a fairly significant refresh at the moment. I think it's a combination of all those things that's causing gremlins in the ad system, that's shutting down loads of ads. Someone has then taken two and two and found five, and before you know it, there's a minor panic. But anyway, that's a very long way of me saying I don't think that's true. I've got no evidence that Facebook has any interest at all in shutting down the ability to advertise our books on Amazon with Facebook ads. None whatsoever.
No. Okay. As you say, it would make no sense, would it? Good. Well, I had quite a good chat with my Facebook rep. I mean, it took a little bit at the beginning for him to get over the basics. Have you heard of our new product, campaign budget optimization, and what do you think of done it? You know, there's, I want to talk to you about dynamic creative. Well, I knew all of this stuff. So, but then when we got down to looking at some of the granular detail in the campaigns, the ones that a bit I drew away from it. First of all, I created a couple of new audiences on people who've interacted with existing campaigns and tried to create lookalike audience, or did create lookalike audiences based on them. Although then used what he says as a tip before you then try and use that audience is check the overlap with existing lookalike audiences. And it was quite significant. So probably not worth me running separate campaigns to them. But I did quite like the way he picked out a little bit of audience that wasn't being well served in my current campaigns, which was women over 65. And he says, sometimes when you see that, if you look down at those demographics and see quite a high click-through rate, it might be worth pulling that out and putting it into a separate campaign to allow it to get more traction, more service than it will get when it's boxed in with everything else and the, you know, the algorithms pushing the money elsewhere. So I thought that was quite a good tip. So I will try 65 plus women this week. Sounds a bit odd saying that, and see if that that works. Yeah, so not all Facebook reps are alike. He seems like a very nice chap from Ireland. Good.
They're all nice.
Yes, yeah. But it is definitely worth, if you're not in our Facebook groups, you know, they're two very, very good groups connected with our courses, of course, Mastery and Genius, which is the one-on-one course and ads in reverse order.
It's worth mentioning that the benefit of those groups, you're probably going to say this, but I'll take the credit for it anyway, was that we're selling books. Right? So all the people in those groups are not selling widgets or courses or cars or tractors or lawnmowers, whatever you can sell with Facebook ads. We're all selling books. So there are some specific idiosyncrasies that relate to what we do, how we do it, you know, the how we track the ads, the profitability of the ads, read through. All of this stuff will basically, you might as well be in Latin for your typical Facebook rep who is not, you know, it's not their fault. They just don't have any experience in the same way that we do. So my advice would be that there are some very, very knowledgeable advertisers who have sold hundreds of thousands of books in the mastery group, in particular for the Ads for Authors course. And my first port of call would be, and often is actually, would speak to those authors in that group, because they will know a lot more than your common or garden Facebook rep.
The hive mind is very useful indeed. Good. Okay. Right. We're going to move on to this week's.
Is your dog barking?
My dog is barking. Yeah. Just looking out the window. We are having.
Who let the dogs out?
There's a decorator in at the moment, and she will bark every time the decorator goes out for more than 5 minutes. She considers that then a breach of protocol to come back in, so she needs to bark.
Well, she's making sure that you're not being ripped off.
Yes. Barking at Chris, our decorator, who it turns out is a Peterborough United fan. So I'm wearing my Cambridge United shirt today because Cambridge beat Birmingham City at the weekend. Which is fabulous news. And I took 3 wickets yesterday in the cricket, along with William, who took 2. So I'm in the happiest mood you could possibly imagine today. And very soon I'm going to be thrashing you at golf when we play golf.
I played golf twice at the weekend. First, Saturday was absolutely diabolical. Sunday was quite good. So,
and define quite good. Impressed.
Well, my first shot, it's going to be very, very boring for most people, but it was a kind of it's a par 3, about 160 yards, and I landed it on the green about 10 feet from the pin with my first shot. Second shot, almost got my first birdie, but just missed it, and then tapped it in for a par. I was quite pleased with. And I only lost one ball yesterday. On Saturday, I lost 6 balls. So okay.
That is the frustrating thing about golf. You can approach it. And sometimes you're on form, sometimes you're not. Okay, look, let's talk about our interviewee. Ikey Flintart. Ikey is in Australia, and she writes books that contain fight sequences, of sort of fantasy books with a martial arts sort of a theme to them. Very successful author, very hardworking author. But she's into martial arts herself as well, along with her husband. Her husband's also a blacksmith, I think I recall from the interview. But that means that she thinks about how to write fight scenes in a way that those of us who don't have that martial arts background and have never been in a proper fight probably don't think about it. So that's like the adrenaline, how different people with different backgrounds and experience will react when they're suddenly confronted in a fight. And all these things are incredibly useful to writers, because your character might be somebody who's set upon in a bar and is not used to that world at all. They are going to behave differently in a fight than somebody who is trained armed forces background or whatever. And this is everything she discusses in her excellent book, How to Fight Like a Girl. And talks about in this interview. I should also say, for people who know Ikey Flintart and follow her online, I did not know before we started the interview that she's had a terminal cancer diagnosis earlier this year, which was a bit of a bombshell in this interview, and sort of knocked me for 6 talking to her. But anyway, that's something just to let you know is discussed in the interview. And obviously, as a shadow over the interview from that point onwards, but Ikey is such a positive person, so into what she's doing, and seemed to really enjoy our chat together, which I'm pleased about. And I think we got a lot out of it. This is not an area. In fact, the only other area we discussed on email afterwards is sex scenes, that we don't really talk about how to approach and how to write them. But fight scenes appear as often as sex scenes, perhaps more often in thrillers and so on. And I think this is a good area for us to discuss. So here's Ikey, and we'll be back for a chat off the back of this interview.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Ikey Flintart joining us all the way from Australia. Thank you very much indeed for coming on to the show. It's always still puzzles me that all this works, this technology. You're sitting about as far away as you can from England, and yet here we are talking to each other, which is great.
It is. It's awesome. And thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I love you guys' podcast. It's a lot of fun to listen to, so glad to be on it.
No. Thank you. I'm really pleased you're here. I'm excited about learning how to fight like a girl, which is, I think I just said to you off air, I feel slightly nervous saying that, but it is the title of one of your books, and we're going to talk a little bit about writing fight scenes, particularly from a female perspective. But let's hear a little bit about you, Aiki. So I think you've been self-publishing for a while now, and I can see, glancing at the online retailers, you're doing well.
Yeah, not too bad. I was one of those random ones that I actually started writing many years ago, and there's so many books in my drawer that will never come out that, you know, we all don't speak of. But about 2010, I wrote a series of 5 books for middle grade kids because my son was interested in reading adventure stories. And I tried to get them published, but I knew nothing about the industry whatsoever. And I'm a bit of a control freak and I'm impatient. So I just went, oh, look, you can self-publish. I'll just do that. So I kind of lucked out because I hit the beginning of the Kindle wave.
What sort of year was this, Aiki? Sorry.
2010, 2011.
Oh, quite early on, yeah.
Yeah, and that series of 5 has actually had, I think, up to about 500,000 downloads now. So that was kind of cool.
Wow.
But then I made a really stupid mistake and didn't realize it was actually doing so well because I have a life as well. And I didn't write anything for 2 or 3 years. So the next books I put out were in 2015. So I'd kind of missed that, you know, keep your audience interested thing that you really need to do and put out more books. So the next lot were harder to get sales on because it was just, I'd lost a lot of the audience. So my own stupid fault.
Best not to dwell on the fact that you didn't publish books in that gloriously fertile period.
Yeah.
But it's done now. And anyway, you've got a presence and I can see that now. Did you do a lot of writing before this period, Aiki? Was this something that just crept up on you or did you always want to...
Oh, look, I've always written. I've still got some of my really terrible things from primary school. And I grew up reading science fiction and fantasy and crime and romance and all of the genres. So it was just kind of natural. You know, my husband, I think, said to me, you really should write. You tell really good stories. I went, oh, all right. Yeah, I should. And then after the ADAD series went so well, I went, hey, maybe I should take this seriously. This is really fun. And look, people like it.
And you're writing, I mean, I can see there's a bit of post-apocalypse, a sort of Japanese theme. Is that, am I seeing that?
Well, I do a martial art called Aikido. So a lot of my heroines and heroes are also martial artists just because, you know, you write what you know a lot of the time. Yeah. But I have one series that's urban fantasy that's actually set here in Brisbane, but current era. And one series that's not so much post-apocalyptic as science fantasy. So it's about 500 years in the future on a colony world, which is settled by idealists from all cultures. So you get a bit of Asian, a bit of Arabic, a bit of Western, which was a lot of fun to research because I had to throw in all these random Asian and Arabic words that confuse the hell out of people. But I figure, you know, people have got to learn these things. We've got to be a bit more culturally aware these days.
And that's what it would be like if you're in that community.
Yeah. If you've ever seen the series, TV series Firefly, where they swear in Mandarin, that was kind of the inspiration. I was like, what a great idea.
Brilliant. You can get away with it like that.
Yeah.
So how many series do you have on the go at the moment? You finished the ADAD series, have you?
Yeah, there's 5 in that series. There's 4 in the futuristic series, the Kalima Chronicles, which is these ones. Iron, Fire and Steel. They were inspired because my husband's a blacksmith and I thought, well, what happens if you have a world that has no iron deposits? You know, how's their culture going to be affected if you suddenly find one when they've never had one before? And the Urban Fantasy, which is that series, has 4 in it at the moment. And I've just recently put out this one, Blackbird Sing, which is a historical fantasy set in England in 1486.
Wow.
And that's actually, that was a challenge. That's a tapestry novel written of 24 short stories that all advance an overarching narrative with 24 different point of view characters. So that was exciting.
Sounds complex.
One, yeah, it was, but so much fun to write. And it's that series is supposed to end up with, I think, 7 books by the time I finish them all. So of all up, I'm pretty sure I'm up to about 20 now, books altogether.
I'm just going to ask you about your writing in a moment, but let me just pause for a moment and wind back. Did you say your husband is a blacksmith?
Yeah, that's where his hobby is. He likes to do blacksmithing. I do martial arts and archery. He does archery as well. So it's a bit of a, you know, apocalyptic family. So when the zombie apocalypse comes, we're fine.
You're fine. You're going to be in demand. So he's not a full-time blacksmith. People don't bring their horses up to the front of the house and he shoes them or anything. Okay.
No, that's a farrier. Blacksmiths
that's
don't
a farrier.
Do that.
Sorry. Yeah. He makes swords. He makes swords. Are those swords behind you, did he make those?
He actually did make this one. Yeah, that's a short sword. Yeah, and the dagger that goes with it.
I should pay attention to Game of Thrones more. Okay. Good. Let me talk to you about writing then. So you're quite prolific by the sounds of it. Talk about your process a little bit, your kind of word count and your timetable for book releases.
It's really tricky at the moment. You may not have seen the news because you probably don't follow me on Facebook, but I've actually earlier this year been diagnosed with terminal melanoma cancer. So all of my time releases went out the window. And it's the last 6 months has just been like, oh my God, what am I doing? How do I make this life work now? Because they've given me maybe 6 to 12 months. So I'm desperately, I know it's a bit of a shit really.
Oh God, Ikey, I'm so sorry. What an absolute, and this was a bolt from the blue, just a.
It was, I literally had a seizure on Christmas Eve and went into hospital and they scanned my brain away. Went, okay, here's the bad news. And it's just been trial and error seeing what drugs will work, but unfortunately nothing's working. So there's not a lot of time, but I have six of these bloody books to write. I don't have time for this.
And you're now thinking, I mean, hopefully, first of all our wishes go with you. And I'm sure they haven't exhausted all the possible options for treatment yet. They're still trying some things. I know you've got to be careful with how you manage that expectation. Yeah. But
I was looking at a list the other day I've made. I recently wrote a book to go after How to Fight Like a Girl, but I wrote this one, which is How to Get Your Black Belt in Writing, which was basically just a consolidation of all of the things I'd gone through in the last 10 years of learning how to write and how to market and how to get things out there. And at the end of it, I went, you know, this is a list of all the stuff I've done in my life. And it's not that I've spent years doing lots of it. I mean, I've spent many years doing martial arts and quite a few years now doing writing, but a lot of the other stuff I've just done once or twice. So just this huge list of bungee jumping and scuba diving and, you know, random stuff that I've tried. And I'm like, I don't have any regrets. I've done everything except go to Mars, which was the only thing on my list that I can't do.
Yeah, so far. Well, I mean, that's hardly compensation for what you're facing, the fact that you've lived your life to the full, but it's amazing and wonderful to hear. But anyway, well, best wishes from everyone here, and I'm sure everyone listening as well is crossing everything and hoping that something somewhere turns around for you. But
you know, it is what it is. If something good comes, that's awesome. But look, you know, to be honest, I've just been contracted by the Queensland Writers' Centre to put together a workshop to help mentor new authors. And that's really what I've been doing for the last probably 6 years is workshops and mentoring and teaching, because I just love it. I love the looks on people's faces when they finally go, that's how first person point of view works, or oh my gosh, that's what showing not telling means. It's just so nice.
I can see with your publications that there has been from the beginning a teacher in you as well wanting to get other people going on this path. Yeah.
Just a little.
Which is great as well. So, I mean, and you've obviously enjoyed your writing. You're enjoying that aspect of it. And I think that's a really key part of imparting stuff, because it should never be a chore.
No.
It should always be something that that you want to do, and that's going to make the books better. And you've obviously got that going for you, Ikey.
Yeah. And I know there's a lot of philosophies out there about how many books you should write and how fast you should write them and what the genre you should write in. And obviously each person makes their own choices based on what they want out of it. And there's nothing wrong with any of those choices. My personal choice is that I just want to write stories because I like writing stories, and I'm not really into it for the money or the fame or the fortune or anything. I like helping people, and all my stories have some sort of theme to them that is designed to help people be better, I guess.
And if we go, obviously, since the diagnosis, things have turned upside down for you. Obviously, priorities changed. So if we go pre-diagnosis, then what was your writing routine and how many books were you publishing?
Yeah, I was at the last couple of years has been doing probably four or so books a year. I've combined my own books with also editing anthologies for other writers. So putting short story collections together for people and teaching those writers how to write. So it's kind of a combination of mine and theirs. But I've generally been doing four books a year, and the Blackbird series is meant to be probably two or three per year for the next 3 years, because they are incredibly complex and involve a huge amount of research. Like, I think it takes me about 4 months to research one thoroughly enough to get it right. And I'm sure people will still pick on me and tell me that I've done something wrong.
They will. There's no question about that. That's how that works. So, that is the challenge of writing actual historical fiction as opposed to fantasy. I mean, I can understand the sort of Game of Thrones approach by Martin is to just shift it slightly into a fantasy world, but more or less based in the real world. Because at that point, you can just say to anybody who says to you, they didn't have that type of iron. At that point, you can say, yes, they did in my world. But
this one does have a slight fantasy element to it, in that it uses the fae, the she from Ireland. And that allows me to stretch the truth a little bit here and there. But, you know, words and characters are as real as possible.
Well, I'm guessing you've enjoyed that research as well.
Oh, yeah. The hard part's getting out of the bloody rabbit holes.
Yeah. Yes,
I just spent 3 hours today learning how to swear in Old Irish.
Yeah, well, you never know. That could be useful.
No.
So, on that colony. Okay, so let's talk about your martial arts is a background for you and obviously is a bit of a passion for you. Was there a specific type, did you say, you did?
Yeah, I tried several back in my 20s, and martial arts is quite a personal thing. You have to find a style that suits you and a dojo and sensei that suits you, because you can end up in a real dojo full of absolute meatheads and it just doesn't work for you, especially if
you're a girl. Dojo's the class and sensei's the instructor, is that right?
Yeah, it is. Okay. Dojo's like the place where you go to train. And I ended up finding, with my husband training with me as well, we were learning an art called Yoshinkan Aikido, which is, if you've ever seen a Steven Seagal movie, it's what he does, but without the bad acting. So
hey, don't diss the Seagal. I love a bit of Steven Seagal.
His martial arts is great.
Yeah.
But I did that for about 20 years. And that involves like not only the martial arts side of thing, it involves sword work and knife work and stick work as well. It's not great on ground work. So it doesn't do a lot of the Brazilian jiu-jitsu ground type fighting. And it doesn't do a lot of the striking like karate and things like that. It's mostly wrist lock and arm locks and joint locks and throws, takedowns, strangles. So it's a great art, but it's very disciplined.
And good for self-defense, I'd imagine, if you've got that ability to put people into arm locks and stuff if they come at you.
Yeah, it's funny, actually. It's you develop a different sort of confidence when you walk around and you get annoyed a lot less. When you have that mentality that, you know, okay, go for it. See how that goes. Kind of you exude that and people stop annoying you so much. It's great.
Well, that's a good part of it, having that discipline, that calmness about you, which knows that I can deal with it if it gets to that point, but I'd rather it didn't.
Yes.
Which is a good thing. Okay, so you've got this background. You obviously enjoyed that. I imagine you've done quite well in it. You strike me as somebody like you who does well at whatever they throw themselves into.
I work myself practically to death to do well at everything.
As we've often said in this podcast, there's no special secret somewhere. It's just applying yourself. So you've introduced this into your books, and I think it's helped inform the way that you write fight scenes.
Yeah.
And honestly, for most of us, you know, I once had a fight with Robin Aykroyd at school when I was 11. I don't really remember very much about it, but that is the beginning, middle and end of my experience in physical combat. I'm probably very typical, or maybe I've got a little bit more experience. So we suddenly find ourselves writing about something we have almost zero personal experience of. So I think I'm guessing that's what you're bringing to some of the conversations you have with writers.
Yeah, trying to, because people tend to write what they see in movies, and that's just not ever going to work, mainly because it's incredibly boring to read. Hit, punch, kick, punch, hit, punch, punch, punch. It's really dull. And, you know, movies are so visual and books are just not. So you have to take advantage of what books do offer, which is that access to the inner workings of the character's mind and how they feel about the whole thing. And that I actually did a survey with my son, who's 23, and a bunch of his friends, and just said, okay, so what makes you skip a fight scene? Because a lot of them said they did skip fight scenes. And they said, oh, we just don't care. We don't care. We just skip to the end to see who survived, and that's all we want to know. So it made me realize that most people really are not interested in what kind of punch got thrown. They just want to know how the person felt about being hit.
Yes. Yeah. So, and I guess that would, so some of your characters will be experienced fighters.
Yeah.
And others will be set upon and flailing about trying to defend themselves, and how you write from their perspective will alter.
Definitely. And that's part of what the Fight Like a Girl goes through, is it's not just about women. It's about the differences between how men and women actually both approach, handle and react to violence in the whole sequence of it. Because it's not just the fight itself. It's everything that leads up to it. It will depend on whether they're male or female, will depend on whether they're trained or untrained, what they see, what they don't see. And as a writer, you get to use all of that to make the scene more immersive. You know, if your girl who's out for a night on the town and has no training walks into a bar, sounds like a joke, and she sees the Midori on the shelf or the rum on the shelf, then that's what that character would notice. But the girl who's trained might notice, I don't know, the slippery floor or the obstacles that are the chairs or the exits where the bathroom is or the shotgun the barkeeper has behind the bar. And then as a writer, you use those implements to foreshadow and then actually be used in the fight scene. And that informs the reader both about the character and about what sort of person they are based on what they see and how they fight. So there's huge differences.
Yeah, that already makes it more interesting hearing it from that perspective. I always remember a poster I saw when I was a reporter in a police cafeteria or something. I had a load of, you know, safety posters up directed at the police. And one of them was something like, are you about to be hit? Are you about to be assaulted? And it had a sort of checklist of things to look for. So the suspects are backing away from you a little bit to give themselves space, avoiding eye contact just before and going calm. Yeah. Are all triggers. I mean, not necessarily people are very different, but these are things that, and I think most policemen said they, after a while, just developed that, that sixth sense that this person's about to have a go.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing you're talking about. Somebody who walks around thinking about that, looking for that, as opposed to the rest of us who are clueless, walking into a bar.
You'd actually be surprised how one of the big differences between males and females is things like women are really good at being aware of micro expressions, which is why often, I don't know if you've ever been out with a girl who says, oh, this dude next to me is a bit of a creep. And, you know, her boyfriend might go, nah, he's fine. I know him. He's great. But she's actually picked up on the micro expressions, which say this dude is a creep. And he may not have, because it's a difference between how men and women actually see the world. And there's so many other differences. Biochemistry is different. Body language is different. How they handle adrenaline is different. There's just so many things that go into it. And even the aftermath. You're married, are you?
I am married, yes.
Have you ever had a fight with your wife and like an argument and you've walked out of the room 5 minutes later, you're fine, you come back in, you try to, you know, patch it up and she's just still going, oh no, this is so not over. Have you ever had that moment?
Do you know what? It's sometimes a little bit the other way around. She's incredibly sanguine and pragmatic and doesn't sulk. I'm the sulky one, has to bring myself around, but I'm aware of that dynamic.
Well, yeah, because most women, the adrenaline curve they ride is a little bit askew from what men's is. So if they're really angry, they get angry a bit later and they stay angry a lot longer.
Right. That second wave.
Yeah, so you can bring all of that into the writing of fight scenes, and if you understand the differences between how men and women react.
Okay, now you've done us this brilliant checklist for writing a fight scene. I think some of the things we've been talking about are drawn into that. This is quite a detailed checklist, and I guess some of it is, as you said, first of all, what is the character's experience? You've got to be aware from Are they going to notice things or be oblivious to it all? Are they prepared? All the rest of it. And then you get into the fight scene itself. Interestingly, your first check, your first point on this checklist is the scene necessary to advance the plot? Which I guess is a question you ask about every scene, right?
It is, yeah. But so many people throw a fight scene in because they think it's a bit slow and they ought to speed things up. It's that and six scenes, the two of them.
And in terms of POVs, I mean, some books obviously are just first person and they're restricted to that. Other books are omniscient, all the rest of it. Is there a particularly, I mean, would you say a fight scene works better when it's written from one person's point of view?
It always has to be the person who's most changed that you're in the point of view of. So whoever's emotionally most affected by the fight. Now, obviously, that's not going to work if you're writing the whole book in a single point of view, in which case you might have to rethink the fight. But it's, you've got to be aware that you're also using the scene to manipulate a reader's emotions. So you need to know what you want the reader to feel. And that also depends on your genre, because for some genres like a thriller, it's fight scene after fight scene after fight scene, and there's pretty much no emotion in it anyway. But if you're writing a romance, then most of what the reader is there for is the emotional element. So your fight scene is going to be really short and from the person who is most affected by it, their point of view. So there's so much that goes into choosing which character to write it from if you've got the option to choose more than one. It's really hard to know, you know, to give a blanket, this is the best character, because it's going to depend very much on the book and the genre.
Yeah, and as you say, the one who's changed the most out of it. The idea of the person who walks in and notices the exits and the microaggressions from whatever from people sitting around, useful, I suppose, to set up something if you want the bar stool or the vodka bottle to be involved in a fight later, to think ahead and when you're writing the scene and have a little bit of that put in place, foreshadowing, as we say.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you have, I mean, what are your this is a detailed checklist, and we're going to send this out with the podcast so people can come and get this.
Oh, that's not even half of it. I was looking at it going, it's getting too long. I have to stop.
Wow. Well, based on what we've said so far, do you have a kind of sort of higher level set of advice for people writing a fight scene that you can give us?
Yeah, the key thing is how much the character is aware. Like, are they even aware that they're walking into trouble or not? And how well equipped are they for dealing with it? How much have they noticed? How many weapons have they got? Are they trained for the weapons or not? Are they male and female? Because that makes a difference to how they handle the whole thing. And how much you can change things up to keep the reader interested. So you don't want to have one big fisty punch, fist in a pub, because that's boring. Find somewhere interesting to set it and switch it up halfway through or three quarters of the way through, so that you get a new setting if you possibly can. And if you watch movies, you'll see they do that. They'll switch up the settings to ramp up the tension. And that's one of the key things to fights, is you've got to keep ramping up the tension all the way through until you get to the darkest hour where things are about to go horribly wrong. And then suddenly your heroine or your hero triumphs at the end. It's almost like a mini full book, if you like. So, and each scene is actually, no matter whether it's a fight scene or not, really should almost have the same structural elements that a full book does. It's just all squished. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah, it's got to be a journey, which is the word that Mark hates, but it is basically that, isn't it?
It is.
A little story in its own right. So in terms of the mechanics of a fight, I mean, if I guess in most situations, you've probably got one protagonist who's good, if they've probably started it and they know what they're doing, and somebody who's very likely suddenly defending themselves without any skills. So, I mean, when you do your martial arts, you presumably envisage the scenario where you've got somebody who doesn't know what they're doing but is coming at you. Presumably you don't teach aggression where you start a fight against somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. But I'm thinking from writing, technically, do we need to understand what humans do to defend themselves and what somebody who knows what they're doing is going to do? Is that a useful set of skills to have?
It actually is incredibly useful, because in terms of how people react emotionally, it is very different between someone who's trained and experienced versus someone who has no experience and no training. the set of chemicals that get dumped into your blood and how you manage that and how you used to, you are dealing with those chemicals is incredibly different based on your ability and skill and experience. So how you write the character, for example, if you're doing a close first person on someone who's untrained, it's all going to be a blur. They're just going to be overwhelmed with adrenaline and fear at all of those feelings, whereas a trained person can handle all of that, can sideline it, and can still get the fight done without being completely swamped and not knowing what to do. There's actually a concept that an American general came up with called, but it's basically a loop that you get stuck in when your brain can't process things because it's never experienced it before. And, nice. You know, you see a knife coming, you go, oh, look, it's a knife. What should I do? And your brain goes, when have I ever dealt with a knife before? And your brain goes, oh, I've never dealt. Oh, I've been stabbed. Oh, no. Hey, what do I do now? Oh, look, I've been stabbed again. Whereas somebody with experience who's dealt with a knife before doesn't get stuck in that loop of, I don't know what to do because I've never done it before. Does that sort of make...
Yeah, it does completely make sense. So from a survival point of view, having thought through things in advance is going to be a big help. Maybe had some experience. I do remember my hostile environments training back in the BBC days when we were taught by these SAS guys.
Cool.
It was really cool. It was a week immersed in this stuff. Most of it was first aid, actually, because they tell you at the beginning that most journalists who die in war zones die from heart attacks and car accidents. Yeah. But then a minority are kidnapped or shot. But they were amazing, these guys. I remember, we had lots of guns to play with, holding a sort of Browning 9mm and saying, so in simple terms, if someone comes at you with a gun, what would you do? And as I finished the sentence, he took it off me.
Yeah.
he just smacked it out of my hand, and he was holding it and I wasn't. He said, well, that's the first thing to do. And that's him living and breathing this every day of the week.
Yeah.
And as I moved the weapon towards him, realised that he could smack it without me even noticing out of his hand. So he's probably saved his own life a few times like that. But
I actually do that demo when I give workshops for people, live workshops. I get someone to hold a plastic gun up and I just take it away from them. They're still going, whoa.
Yeah, exactly. And they the stories they told us, I can't even repeat some of them, but they were serving in parts of the world where the people coming at them were amateurish. You know, they weren't all like on the films, highly trained assassins. They were sometimes kids with guns in parts of the world.
It's not happy, not nice.
No, not at all. But key point here is really important. I can see it thematically in your checklist is what is the world experience of your person you're writing, because the way that they're going to envisage it, as you say, is going to be very different indeed. Flailing about, getting lucky, I suppose, if your guy's completely
untrained. Flailing is the key response to the untrained person. It's just flail.
You never know. It might work. Flailing arms everywhere.
It actually, one of the fun things is that untrained women actually fight quite differently to untrained men. And I like to call it basically a 70-kilogram cat. If you imagine a 70-kilogram angry cat, that is pretty much how a woman fights when she's not trained.
I'm never fighting a cat. I can tell you that now. Coming off second best every day of the week.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, let's come up with a URL for this. So we always do this live during the interview, but I'll write it down and remember it. But if we say selfpublishingformula.com/fight, F-I-G-H-T, I think that's a nice little URL, and we will send out this, as I say, it's quite a detailed checklist.
Yeah.
Mainly for female characters, but you've got and in brackets and male characters as well.
Yeah, because the book actually does deal with both options, because you have to know both. If you're a female writer, you've got to understand the difference between how men and women fight. Otherwise, it's not going to come across realistic to your male writers.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Do you also have to consider the level of detail you're going to go into, depending on what sort of level of visceral detail you want in your book. Some books are going to be gore and violence, and that's kind of the fan service that they're serving. Middle grade books are going to be written in a very different way. And there's a bit of a challenge there, isn't there?
I liken it to the difference between writing, say, the fight scene in Princess Bride, which pretty much everyone has seen now. You know, it's all witty banter and fancy footwork and no blood is spilled. And then, you know, comparing that to some of the horror movies where there's guts and blood all over the ceiling by the time the scene's finished.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to revisit Suzanne Collins. Is it Suzanne Collins? Have I got that name right? Hunger Games. For writing essentially young person's novel centered around visceral violence, because there's a trick to that.
I haven't read her books. I watched the movies, but I haven't read the books. So I'd be interested to know what she's done differently as well.
Yeah, again, I think the more you become immersed in somebody's own perspective about it is probably safer territory rather than being the sort of camera view of the blood splats.
Yeah, and like I said, my son's friends and everything were quite adamant that they really didn't care about what kind of punch or how many guts got spilled. They just wanted to know how people felt about it.
Yeah. And just to round off the section on fighting, going back to the beginning, when you come up to this scene in your book, it's got to serve a purpose, right? As you say, you've got to drive through it. And at the end of this, have been moved on in the book. Yeah. Otherwise, there's no point in having it.
Yeah. And it has to, like, one of the things I really like to do in my books is have the plot, the theme, and the character arc are all pretty much so closely intertwined that every scene has to affect all three of them. And that gives the reader a sense of satisfaction because the character has grown, the plot has been advanced, and you've underscored the theme of the whole story as well, all in one hit. And if you can advance a subplot as well, then you're bonus points.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, your writing's obviously very strong, Ikea. In fact, I see that you've won a few awards.
Well, I've been shortlisted and top eight listed and finalist for several, but I haven't quite managed to win one yet.
That's annoying.
The Australian Speculative Fiction Aureolus Awards are a very hard fight to win. So it's a huge, the Australian spec fic writers are amazing. They're such good writers.
That's fantastic. Do you find in Australia, because of your geographic location to East Asia, that you do get a little bit more of the martial arts, Japanese perhaps influence in writing?
I don't know that I've noticed that it's any different. I mean, martial arts are so widespread across the world these days and so many different types that it creeps into a lot of writing, even if people don't realise it.
Yes.
Like, we'll blame Jackie Chan and his amazing movies for making it all popular and Jet Li and all and Bruce Lee. But we certainly do, like a couple of my very good friends, Kylie Chan and a couple of others, Tracy Harding, they both write martial arts girls as well, which is great. So there's this little group of us who all write these badass women, which is so much fun.
All your books have female leads?
No, the ADAD series actually has two. It has a 14-year-old boy and a 14-year-old girl, and they both get dumped into their 17-year-old avatars in a computer game set back in 80 AD. So it's equal points of view. But one of the key things that I really do try very hard to do is write my male characters, the sub characters, if they're not the point of view, I try to write them as equals to the women and the women equals to the men. Because I think that's a pretty important message to get across to people these days is that, you know, okay, not all the characters have to be kick-ass women to be equals. They just have to be women and they can still be on an equal footing even if they don't kick butt and kill people.
Just seen as unquestionable that there's equality.
Yeah.
So, Ike, you've got this terrible news, devastating news, and have you planned your sort of books over the next few months? Or?
Yeah, I've been trying desperately to get them out this year, the ones I already had sort of half done. So I got this one, this was a heap of fun. Does this come out the right way for you? Does it come backward?
No, that's correct. Zookeeper's Tales of Interstellar Oddities. Sounds brilliant.
This was a collaboration between myself and Pamela Jeff, who's another spec fic writer, and we both wrote this science fiction series of short stories all set in a bar in space in the middle of, you know, the future 500 years or so. It was just so much fun to write all these amazing short stories, and we just like, we've got to get this out this year. And then I really want to get the sequel to Blackbirds out this year as well, and that's partially done too. So it keeps me going, stops me from lying around on the couch like a lachrymose seal whining about my life.
I can't imagine for one moment you lying around on the couch doing nothing. You seem like a very incredibly purposeful person, Ikey. Look, thank you so much indeed for joining us. And particularly thank you for the insight on writing fight scenes, which now we come to talk about. And I don't think we've ever spoken about this over 3 years of this podcast. I don't think it's an area that people really think about ahead of time. But what a difference it will make to the authenticity of the scene.
Absolutely, yeah.
To get inside someone's, to understand in advance the different perspectives, how that's going to feel. And all I can say is good luck.
Yeah, it'll be fine. Either way, it's all good. I'll end up in Valhalla with, you know, Thor and swilling ale or something.
Yeah, watch out for Odin. You know what he's like.
Oh, Odin's not bad. It's Loki you've got to look out for.
Loki, yes, that's it. Well, look, it's inspirational hearing how you're dealing with it. I would be in a crumpled heap on the sofa. That would be it.
Been there, done that. Ben went out and picked up my throwing knives and threw them at the brain scans that showed me my 13 tumours. You know, it was like very cathartic.
Good. Best of luck, Ikey. All we can say to you now, and stay in touch. Let us know how things are going, and yeah, if we can help you, you let us know.
Will do. Thanks, James.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There we go. Have you had many fights in your life, Mark?
Oh, frequently. Yeah, can't you tell? I'm vicious.
Didn't you punch a rock star once?
A rock star tried to punch me. Lemmy from Motorhead took a swing at me in the Sunset Bar the Rainbow on Sunset Boulevard, which is about as glamorous as my life ever got. Yeah, he missed. He was quite drunk. He missed. I ducked underneath it and then then ran away, basically. I'm not a big fighter. It might not be a surprise to anybody.
So when you write these fight scenes, where's your knowledge coming from? You presumably you have fight scenes. Well, I know you do because I've read a couple of your books.
Yeah. I think you just put yourself in the, it's just imagination, isn't it? I think for me, it's language choice is quite important. So you don't want to have flowery language that detains the reader too much. You're not trying to write beautiful fight scenes. They should be visceral and staccato and short sentences, you know, very short paragraphs to convey a sense of pace and threat and things like that. So that would be, and that's how I've always done it. Obviously, you know, we've both watched lots of film. I'm sure that how I write those scenes and how I write everything really has been influenced heavily by the films that I've seen. And that could be, you know, Bollywood films. It could be kind of Wing Chun films, Chinese films, all kinds of different things. Hollywood blockbusters, the Bourne films, Shaky Handheld. All this stuff is all kind of mixing and merging to form experience that I can draw on when I'm writing those kinds of scenes. I think I don't do a bad job of it. I think I'm quite good at that. But you can always be better. So this is a good interview.
And just to repeat that we mentioned in the interview, there is a handout to go with this to help you craft more realistic and exciting fight scenes. If you go to selfpublishingformula.com/fight, F-I-G-H-T, you can get that from Ikey. And all we can do is just wish Ikey well. I find it quite inspirational listening to her talk and how she's dealt with this. She did describe that she's been through the desperate phase of it all and staring into the abyss and is now, I think, coming to terms with something I would find almost impossible to come to terms with and just plan things out. And, our heart goes out to her and her family. And we just wish her, well, all we can hope for is some sort of miracle, but we wish her that. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Mark. As we mentioned in the first half of this show, don't forget that we do have Facebook groups you can join. If you just search Self-Publishing Formula on Facebook, you'll see the genre-specific groups and then the big community group, FSPF Secret Group, I think it's called, which will be a good place for you to check in first when you start to get those alarming emails from Facebook and other people. That's it. We'll be back next week, so thank you. All that remains for me to say is it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.